Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. In conversation with some people earlier today, there was a question about the nature of contemplation or wise reflection in Buddhist practice. So I thought that might be a useful, interesting theme to explore, to look at a little bit this evening. Sometimes when we hear about Buddhist meditation or read books or go on retreats, listen to teachings, then it seems there's varieties of different kinds of meditation practice, but mostly focused on say the element of concentration, training the mind to focus on a single point, or what's called samatha or calm tranquility meditation. That's the main focus. Or there's that of vipassana or insight, and developing the capacity to see into the very nature of experience itself. And so these are often talked about as a pair, as a duet: samatha vipassana, calm and insight, tranquility and insight. And so it can come across that's the whole repertoire of Buddhist practice. And we might have some idea that there are sort of devotional practices or recollections that one can do, what are called the anusati, so bhutanusati, dhammanusati, and so on, which is recollecting the qualities of the Buddha and the Dhamma, or the where you're in a way more of a development of faith. Devotional practice, or say the qualities of reflection that, say in the monastery that we do. Maybe you come across that reflecting on the alms food before we eat it, wisely reflecting: I use alms food not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, and so on. But we can easily think of those as being very secondary or circumstantial, peripheral sorts of practice, and that the main core, the main focus of practice is that of developing concentration, jhana or samatha, and that of insight. But there's a whole area of practice, what we call wise reflection, yoniso manasikara, wise reflection, contemplation, that is a large part of the development of wisdom and also of concentration. It's and so too of faith. It's like a supportive quality, supportive range of practices that go a long way to helping these other helpful, skillful attributes to be developed. And this particular area is something that our teacher Ajahn Chah and also Ajahn Sumedho, the senior Western monk, Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, have developed very, very strongly and taught a lot, you know, over the years. And so it's in a way important to look at that and explore what is that? What is contemplation? What is wise reflection? How does that work? Because maybe when you look it up in a Buddhist dictionary or you look into a handbook, it says, oh, you know, the wise reflection equals, you know, these formal recitations of, you know, reflecting on your clothing or your shelter or your food, medicines, or reflecting on the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and so on. And you might think, well, that's, you know, all very well, but it's not terribly significant or central. Well, the words contemplation or consideration, those English words are useful pointers to this. Because the word contemplation or to contemplate comes from the Latin roots con, which means with, in association with, connected to, and then templum. The templum is where we get the word temple from, which we generally think of as being some sort of religious building. But in its original meaning, the word templum referred to a designated area of maybe of the open ground, or even, you know, like of a forest, or even of the sky, that when you had soothsayers or astrologers or diviners of one kind or another, they would mark out that particular templum, and then by seeing what kind of patterns appeared in that, whatever animals or birds or clouds or different things that appeared within the templum, within that bounded area, then they would be they would read those signs and symbols and make some kind of prediction or take some sort of reading of the nature of things. So to contemplate is, in a similar way, is to mean means to be within the temple or with the temple, bounded by the temple, the templum. So it's creating that same kind of sacred boundary and looking. What's the activity within there? And just, as in the Roman world, people would look at the birds or clouds or different animals that would appear within that. So similarly, to contemplate within Buddhist practice has that same kind of aspect of defining a boundary and then looking at what goes on within that, seeing what appears within our consciousness. Also the word consider, the word siddha, S-I-D-E-R, means a star. And consider is with the stars, watching the stars. What are the stars doing? What are the planets doing? What are they telling us? So to consider means to watch the stars, or to be with the stars, to look what they're doing, to be guided by that, to read the patterns and that are there, and to be guided accordingly by that. So wise reflection then is and contemplation in Buddhist practice is a way of looking at a particular area of experience, kind of defining a boundary, and exploring it, paying close attention to that zone of experience, and seeing what happens there, seeing how it works, seeing what appears and what things affect each other in what different ways. So that in a practical sense, what this means is that rather than just say when we're trying to develop concentration, and trying to just push aside all thoughts or feelings or emotions or distracting sounds that we hear or feelings in the body, then we can use this process of contemplation or exploring, picking up that theme, if we're particularly bothered by a repetitive thought, or we find a sound of somebody else in the room particularly annoying, or the mind is drawn to a particular fantasy or a plan. So then to use wise reflection or investigation We can use this, these terms, yoniso manasikara, which means to pay attention to the root or the origin, the source of things. Or dhamma vichaya, to investigate the nature of things. These are pretty synonymous terms. So we can use that quality of investigation to explore, why is that noise so irritating? Why is this plan so compelling? Why do I feel I can't let the mind settle down until I've got my future planned out? Or why is this feeling in the body so distressing or so upsetting or so unbearable? The most superficial or obvious aspect of contemplation then, or investigation, is like a skillful and deliberate use of thought. So oftentimes in meditation, thought is looked upon as the great villain. It's like this sort of brain disease, sort of nasty kind of fungal infection of the brain. And the random thoughts just go on and on and on, thinking about this and planning that and recollecting this and creating complaints about that and chattering on about all kinds of pointless and useless, kind of heated and irritated things. So we can relate to thought in terms of trying to develop concentration of, like, you don't belong, get out of here, and we sort of try to push the thoughts away. If we are, say, there's already a degree of steadiness and focus in the mind, and we're more aiming at trying to develop insight, vipassana, and then whatever thought arises, then we don't want any thoughts to appear. But if they do appear, then they immediately get blasted with anicca, dukkha, anatta, your unsatisfactory, impermanent, not self. Get out of here. So we're looking to the nature, and the fundamental fabric of thought, or just trying to push thought away. So that in its initial sense, the wise reflection or exploration, investigation, is like a deliberate use of thought. So you're using the capacity to think to, in a way, explore what is it that's causing the mind to be disturbed? What is it that's causing the mind to get carried away and get caught up? Or if the mind is continually snagging on a particular train of thought, or is buying into a train of thought, and it's coming up over and over again, that we can use that quality of wise reflection to explore, well, why is it so impossible to see the impermanence or emptiness, unsatisfactoriness of this particular thought? Why does it seem so real? So as a questioning quality, as an examining, like picking something up and looking at it, and so that as a deliberate and conscious use of thinking. Now, obviously for this to be wise reflection rather than just sort of chaotic reflection, confused reflection, or an investigation of Dhamma, investigation of reality rather than an investigation of agitated confusion, there needs to be a certain degree of stability, first of all, because it's easy to fool ourselves, as probably most of us know. It's easy to just convince ourselves that we're reflecting in a thematic way, or we're exploring something, but we maybe did that for about 3 seconds, and then the rest has just been a blur of conceptual proliferation and just agitated nonsense. So it's helpful to and significant, crucial really, if we want to cultivate the capacity for reflection and exploration, to really use this quality of investigation to establish as much of a quality of calm and focus as we can. So that in that respect, then, to establish a sitting posture that is as relaxed as possible, the body as steady and at ease as possible, and to establish as much of a basis of calm as we can do. And when there is a degree of calm, then we use that calmness to help support the quality of exploration. And when there's a disturbance or the mind is carried away, then we use that quality of exploring. Okay, what's this? You know, why am I getting upset by this? Why does the mind want to think about the crickets or want to think about the other people in the room rather than just stay with the feeling of the breath or whatever the meditation object might be? So that kind of questioning or exploring and picking something up and looking at it. So if there is a degree of steadiness, then the way that we can develop this quality of investigation, of reflection, is bringing up that examining attitude. What is this? Why is that so important? Or why does that feel so compelling? And the way that we can establish and sustain that quality of reflection is like bringing up an observation or a question, and then just let it hang there, just let it hover in the mind. So it's almost like you're asking yourself a question. You're bringing something up to your own attention, and then almost listening for the answer, or just say, what's that about? And just attending, letting those thoughts, those words, that question just be brought into the space of the mind, and then listening to attend, to see what arises from that, and then as something follows, something arises from that initial thought. Well, why is that so interesting? Why does that seem so compelling? Then just to open up the mind to that, and then maybe, you know, a following thought arises. Oh, that's because, you know, last week there was this big issue about such and such. Oh yeah, why did that upset me so much? What's that about? Well, it's because you got criticized. That's why it upset you so much. Oh yes. Why is criticism so painful? If I've made a mistake, why is it so painful to have that pointed out? What is it that's hurt by being criticized? If all dhammas are not self, what is it that is upset or agitated, pained by being criticized? What is that? How does that feel? So I'm just using this as an example. Just so you're bringing up an observation, listening, seeing what arises, holding that, letting that hover in the space of the mind, and then if something else arises, then following that. And every so often, if you pursue a train of reflection in this way, that you can tell that it really is the yoni soul manasikara. It really is an investigation. If there's that measured, spacious quality to it, that you can notice the spaces between the phrases or the motions of thought. If it's just a blur of chatter, then that's not that isn't. You can be pretty sure that's not wise reflection. That's just conceptual proliferation. You know, the thinking mind just being given a legal excuse to chatter away and call it meditation. It's legal. I'm reflecting. Kind of yada 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 yada. So it's just the agitated desire mind getting carried away. It's got the keys to the car and it's going to go out and have a run. So there's a measured, steady quality to things if there is a real genuine quality of reflection there. Also, you can one of the things that or attributes or ways of reflecting on our experience, and it's particularly this whole methodology I find it particularly helpful for exploring our emotional reactivity when we love something or we hate something, we're afraid of something, we're excited by something, we feel sad about something. then which it's particularly helpful to pick up and explore emotions in this way, because emotions are naturally blurry. The mind gets caught up and carried away, and we get swept into the story. And so this whole quality of exploration and using thought and the power of thinking to explore that, it's in a way it counterbalances the sort of intensity or blurriness of emotions. And it's not trying to be cold and clinical, but it is an analytical method, because if you notice, this is a particular characteristic of the Buddha in the Theravada teachings in the Pali Canon. The Buddha has a very analytical turn of mind. He explores things. He kind of says, okay, well, this leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to this. He traces the patterns that nature works in, both externally and internally, how the causality of consciousness functions, what the cause is, what the effect is, what that effect causes, and then what the result of that is, and so on and so on and so on. Chains of causation and connection, tracing them from one thing to another and seeing how they fit together. So it's particularly helpful to explore our emotional reactions when we love something, we want something, then to use wise reflection to say, I really want to have something to eat. I really want to travel to this other place. I really want to, I'm really looking forward to when this retreat is over, and then I can go off to such and such a place. So the mind seeking an object, and then so to pick that up, and then to take that desire and say, oh, this is the feeling of desire. So when desire operates, then we're convinced that if we have that object, if we acquire that reach that goal, if we acquire that experience, then we will be happy. So you can then explore that emotion of desire, and then follow it through, and just to ask yourself, well, okay, is that really true? If I had that result, if I did get to make that journey, then for sure I'd be would make me totally happy. Or if I did go to this place, or did get something to eat, then I'd be guaranteed that if I had that, I would be happy. That would make me feel complete. Is that possible? Could that really do that? And again, in the same way, just thematically asking yourself the question, exploring, is that possible? Would it work that way? Or with the feeling of fear, the seeing that the mind moved by anxiety, afraid of what's going to happen to us, or what other people think of us, or afraid of some action that we performed that we don't want others to find out about, that we're afraid of getting caught at. Do they really know what I've done? Are they going to find out that lie I told? That thing that I'm trying to keep secret from everybody else. You know, people know. I'm sure they know. I hope they don't find out. What will they think of me? Fear, anxiety. Then just to take that quality of fear and say, okay, well, this is the feeling of fear. Where, you know, what are you afraid of? And who is it that's afraid? And again, you know, with this kind of question, you're not looking for particular conceptual answers or verbal answers, but just dropping that kind of thought or that observation into the space and seeing what arises. What's there to be afraid of? I'm afraid that people will find out the truth. Oh, so the truth is something to be afraid of. That's interesting. Why should the truth be frightening? And to whom is the truth frightening? And then, again, if the mind sort of picks that up and starts running with it, then the thing to do is just, you know, drop the exploration for a moment, come back to the body, relax, come back to the breath, kind of calm everything down, let everything settle and bring the mind to a quality of focus, and then go back to it. So, well, I hit the red button there, that, you know, just had that thought and then the mind raced off. So, okay, let's go back to that one again. So, it was when I asked the question, who is it that's afraid? Why should truth be frightening? That's when the mind really panicked. That's interesting. Why should the mind panic at the idea of the truth being frightening. Who is it that's afraid? What is it that's afraid of truth? What is that? So again, coming back and exploring in that way. Also just you know, that taking things to an absurdity is also helpful, where we follow through the logical trains of thought. The mind is desiring something, or is afraid of something, irritated by something, planning something. Just if we follow it through, sort of give the mind what it asks for, and take things to their logical conclusion. Yeah, you can very easily reveal how crazy a lot of the thinking and the emotional lurches of the mind are. We don't realize how ridiculous a lot of the fears and desires and aversions and plans and opinions and judgments that we make are. We just are not aware of that because we don't really follow them through. They're convincing because they're blurry. If we clarify them, and we can use the power of contemplation to carry them through, then pretty soon it's just ridiculous. It's like, oh yes, if I got to have everything the way that I wanted, if I was able to control the way this monastery is run. Yeah, if everyone acted exactly as I require, I know how this monastery should be run, I know how we should do things, I know what's important, what's not important, and if everyone did exactly as I said all of the time, then this would be the perfect monastery. I would be totally happy all of the time. Nothing could upset me. If everyone just did as I said. There was a famous photoshopped picture they once did of when Ajahn Jayasaro was the abbot of Wat Phananachad in Thailand. They took a group photo of the whole community, of, I guess, 25, 30 monks and novices, maybe even more. And they one of the monks took Ajahn Jayasaro's face and photoshopped it in onto the neck of each of the monks and novices. So there's this group photo, and they all had Ajahn Jayasaro's head. And then the caption was, "The perfect monastery." See, if that's what it was like, if everyone just thought like me, then this would be the perfect monastery. And so, you know, you take it to an absurdity, and you know, we chuckle because it is ridiculous. But that's the way that we can feel. Like, why isn't he like me? She's doing that all wrong. She shouldn't be that way. That's not right. And we can get so sort of indignant and upset about the different characteristics that we have, and not realize that that reasonableness is absurd. It's totally ridiculous. But we don't realize that because it's all just those judgments are made in a blurriness of half formed thinking. It's not clearly tracked. But when we use this kind of contemplation, we say, okay, let's take that thought, let's take that judgment. Okay, Ajahn Pasano is doing it all wrong. Ajahn Amaro doesn't know what he's talking about. I know the way this should be done. Just because they've been doing this decades longer than I have, that's got nothing to do with it. If I was in charge, we would do it like this. That would be the right way to do it. And you know, when you actually spell it out, you know, you can. I find you can barely finish a sentence before you just start kind of chuckling to yourself because this is so ridiculous. But we don't realize that when it's just murmuring along in the background of our mind. So that this kind of reflection and contemplation is like taking those murmurs, those judgments, those opinions, those fears, those desires, those passions, those ever so reasonable commentaries, and just getting them out of the wings and bringing them, stage center, putting the lights on and say, okay, talk to me. tell me what your story is. Plead your case. Tell me. And then the problem is that if the lights are on and they're held center stage, that none of these stories and judgments and emotional reactions will stand up. they won't hold together. So it's really helpful. And this is a kind of practice. Ajahn Sumedho, he's particularly gifted at taking things to absurdity. He has a very strong absurdist streak in his mind. He's a very serious monk in many ways. He's been a bhikkhu for over 40 years, but he does have a wonderfully absurdist streak. And so so he would talk in this way and encourage this a lot, and it's incredibly helpful. But you need to take the trouble to do it, to follow things through, to pick up the judgments and trains of thought, and to learn to not to take ourselves so seriously. Because we don't realize how much suffering we create by A, believing in our thoughts, and then B, taking them totally seriously. When we rather than just try to wipe out our thoughts with concentration, or dismantle our thoughts with insight, or believe in our thoughts with ignorance, we just let them say their piece, and we explore them. Then we find it far more easy to not believe them. They lose their power, and we find it much easier just to experience the nature of see the nature of experience itself, to see thoughts as arising and ceasing, when their innate absurdity is apparent to us. And this kind of exploration, contemplation, is ideal for that. Yeah, because we do take ourselves so seriously. I was recollecting today, I'm not quite sure why it came to mind, but years and years ago, I was at some kind of conference with Ajahn Sumedho. I was a junior monk, and he'd taken me along as his helper. And for some reason or other, we were reflecting on his eventual death, what it was going to be like when he was old and dying. And so my mind, we were walking along someplace through the gardens of this conference center, and just imagining the scene, and I was saying, yes, and yeah, when you're very old and been fading for weeks and weeks, and then all of your disciples have gathered around, and the nuns and monks are all gathered around, and you've been fading slowly, and your ability to communicate is getting fainter and fainter, and less and less often will you utter any words at all, and your breath is getting lighter and lighter, and then we're beginning to realize, oh, any moment now is going to be his last breath, and you're lying there on your deathbed, breath getting shallower and shallower, and then just before the end, your eyes will flicker, will open, and then you'll say, and I was just sort of kind of riffing on this theme and just chatting away, and I'm usually one who's never short of words, and I got to that point of this little creative splurge, and I hit the words, and then you'll say, and he stopped and turned around to me and said, tell Laura I love her. So he has that kind of a mind, you know, that will come up with something like that out of the blue in the strangest moments. So it really helps if we learn how not to take ourselves too seriously, and to be able to listen to our own minds. Now also, contemplation isn't just a dependent on conceptual thought. It's there's a very beautiful exchange, a kind of questions and answer session Ajahn Chah had with a number of Western monks and novices that's been printed up in a few different books. And that they're asking what contemplation is. What is investigation? And he says, he makes a point of saying, well, real contemplation is not just words, it's not just thought, it's actually wordless. But we use the thought to bring the mind to that contemplative state, to that contemplative quality. So it's that, it's really, it's the words are helping us to key the mind into that exploratory state, that quality of interest and investigation. But that investigation is not a word or an idea or a thought. So that we use the thoughts, you know, asking a question like, "What is this?" or "Why is that so interesting?" or, you know, "Who is it that's afraid?" So we use a conceptual thought, but the actual contemplation is more like the change of heart. It's the "Oh yeah, what is that?" And it's that which is looking and also able to intuit the patterns that are underlying experience, the patterns in which experience works and that the nature is actually formed in. That's the real contemplation. And so even though we might use words to help bring the heart to that quality, it's important not to get stuck on the words or feeling like there's got to be some words if there's going to be some contemplation going on, if there's investigation. It's got to be a wordy thing. And sometimes the words just get in the way. And the actual contemplation or the real digestion of the experience, the real apprehension of what's being experienced is a wordless quality. It's best sustained in a wordless way. I remember one time I was very, very upset about something. I was very regretful and I'd made some pretty poor judgments and had been at a Sangha meeting, thoroughly roasted by most of the other people in the meeting, fairly systematically criticized and blamed and justifiably so. And one after another, I was just being told how wrong and bad and stupid my actions had been and worthy of criticism. And so this was extremely painful and upsetting to hear, and so then this particular day, you know, it was a meeting. The meetings were over several days, and so that this had all been in the air on the first day, and then the meetings for the second day were about to begin, and I was in this extremely sort of grim and depressed state just before the second round of meetings was about to begin. And I remember sitting in this room and just incredibly miserable. And I'd been a monk for about 15 years or so, and I'd never cried since I'd been a monk. And then I just realized, I was just feeling this extraordinary mental painfulness, this incredibly sad feeling, and I just started crying. The tears just started rolling down my face, just this feeling of regret and how stupid I'd been and the sort of mistakes I'd made and how bad and wrong and I'd kind of blown it completely and et cetera, et cetera. So there was this upwelling of this very, very sad and grief-stricken feeling, and the tears started flowing. And then my mind started to pick that up, and I said, "Well, this is interesting. And this is a." And so I went into this sort of verbal contemplation. Well, this is a sad feeling. Where does this come from? What can we do about this? And as soon as I started to sort of try and do something with it or use the conceptual thought, then the tears stopped. And it felt like the mind had sort of clamped down and had got caught up and obstructed. So then I stopped thinking And as soon as I stopped thinking, then there was more of the painful feeling and the tears started flowing again. And so even though it was painful, it was actually a much more open and sort of real quality. And then after a little while of that, then the investigator came in again and said, I wonder why this is such a painful feeling, and what's this all about really? This is all anicca, dukkha, anatta. This is all unsatisfactory and impersonal and not self. And coming at it again with this same sort of verbal thought, this conceptual analytical thought. And then as soon as the words came in, then again the tears stopped and it felt like everything clamped down. I thought, that's really interesting. As soon as the mind starts to think, then the experience or that this kind of emotional quality is obstructed or is being masked or is being kind of clung to and then hidden. And actually the real contemplation or really being with the experience was the real mindfulness of what was going on was sustained in the wordlessness. So I could see that the less words there were, the less of a conceptual thought, the more fully that quality of experience could be contemplated, could be known. And that any kind of explaining or exploring or verbalization around it just got in the way. So then, so that was a really insightful moment. So even though it was in a way painful, just to let that grief be known and just to let the tears come, it was actually much more of a way of knowing it fully and completely, and in a way really knowing the impermanence and the unsatisfactoriness and selflessness of it, but without any kind of little inner commentator saying, this is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. So sometimes the verbalization is not a leading into or a facilitation of letting go, but it's actually distracting from the letting go. It's getting in the way. And that sometimes that the contemplation and the real penetration, the understanding, the real receiving, knowing of an experience or of a quality is through that a very pointedly and deliberately wordless receptivity, a wordless knowing, and that the less verbiage, less kind of commentary and conceptualization around it, then the more fully something can just arise and do its thing and pass away. And then, sure enough, after another half hour or so, 3/4 of an hour went by, then that whole wave of grief and sadness has sort of passed through, and then I was ready for the meeting. Which was still difficult, but but it was in its own strange way. It was a powerful experience and a teaching about the nature of being able to contemplate that, so that within that templum, within that framework, that was what was arising. Those particular dark birds, flying through and covering the sky. Oh, there's much that could be said about this quality, yoniso manasikara, wise reflection. But its main quality, I feel, is, and its usefulness is a powerful tool that we can use in meditation, and not something that is to be sort of ignored or brushed aside. But it's that, or in a way, learning to use the capacity to direct attention, to use conceptual thought, to use language, to use that quality of holding the attention on a particular area, and And seeing how much that can facilitate both the aspects of concentration, of insight, and that it's a powerful tool to develop, and that if one uses it in a consistent way, it becomes a most wonderful companion. And it is also something that's important to recognize. It doesn't just have a usefulness on the meditation cushion. But if a little while ago we were reading some of the biography of Ajahn Chah, and that his accounts of his own practice involves a huge amount of this kind of inner dialogue, just describing as he's walking through the countryside, or he's sewing a robe, or he's talking with a teacher, or doing all kinds of different things. And he recounts these inner dialogues and explorations and inner reflections that are going on. So it's something that we can develop very sort of formally and thematically and get the hang of it in a stylized situation of say walking meditation, sitting meditation. And it's easiest to develop it in a clear and consistent way in those more stable and controlled situations. But it's a skill that once we've developed it, that then is an incredibly useful tool, just as we go about our different activities, as we're working or interacting with other people, as we're going from one place to another. That whole exploratory process, that way of picking up experience, looking at our reactions of love and hate, happiness and unhappiness, comfort, discomfort, the arising of opinions and, you know, desires and fears. It becomes like the whole manner in which we process experience. It sort of becomes like the filter, which is the means whereby we understand the way in which the world is being interpreted and held. So it becomes like a very powerful and useful tool. It becomes like a constant companion, so that it's even though we're not in a formal sort of situation of meditation, it becomes the way in which the realm of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, you know, thought, feeling, perception, emotion, memory, the physical body, that these are all, you know, understood and explored and become familiar, the patterns that the mind and the world move in become clearly known to us. And as those patterns are clearly known, then we can see where the grasping of liking and disliking, pushing away and grasping hold, where they form, those habits form. And then that, seeing where that happens, seeing how those habits of grasping and rejecting are formed, then there's the possibility for the heart to not follow those patterns, to be liberated from that, to not be blindly drawn into that. So it's a tremendously powerful support for mindfulness, just seeing how the mind continually creates judgments and urgencies and fears and compulsions, gotta have, can't stand, need more, gotta get away from, don't like, want extra, and so on and so on. We're able to know all of that and to understand it and not be confused or disturbed by that. It's a tremendously sort of powerful, stabilizing presence. And a tremendous support for mindfulness, so that we are able to genuinely have a quality of sati, sati sampajanya, sati panya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, mindfulness and wisdom. It's a powerful tool for really integrating that and to guide the mind, the heart, towards a clear and non-reactive quality, so that we're able to respond to life and understand it, rather than just be, you know, blown around by it, and then using meditation as a way of sort of getting away from that experience of being buffeted it becomes the tool with which we digest the buffetings of the world. We receive them, know them, and learn from them. And that learning then leads to the quality of peace, true peace and freedom. So I offer these words for consideration.
Annamayam dhamma kataya sadhukaram dhamma se sadhu.